One of the most helpful things I've learned as a leader is that I've learned to pay attention to throughout the years that every organization, no matter how big or small, has certain organizational assumptions that exist. Happens for every company, every organization that any of them that makes decisions, all of them, whether it's a nonprofit, whether it's a company, a business, a for-profit model, whether it's an organization like a family, every organization makes decisions based on certain assumptions. Assumptions about what's needed, what's not needed. Assumptions about the economy, assumptions about the culture or their particular market, assumptions about what people want and don't want, assumptions about the past, assumptions about the future. And every decision in the organization is based on certain assumptions. But since life moves so quickly and decisions often have to be made so quickly, one of the greatest challenges for any organization is to hit the pause button long enough to ask, what is it that we are assuming that is informing our decisions? What is it that we are assuming that's informing the decisions that we're making? Because when you do that, one of the things that you discover is that many of the things that you assume to be true aren't actually true. And you end up making decisions based on false assumptions. And when things don't get worked out, then all sorts of things get blamed. People get blamed, decisions get blamed, circumstances, situations get blamed. But what often can be overlooked is, again, this willingness to go back one step farther and ask, wait a second, what are the assumptions that we're carrying with us that are informing our beliefs and therefore informing our decisions that we're making? That's an incredibly helpful exercise for any organization, however big, however small, to walk through. But we don't just do that organizationally. We do a very similar thing with God. We can find ourselves carrying around particular assumptions from time to time. Assumptions like, well, if I show up at church and I pray and I give, then God is going to make my life easier. Or assumptions like, you know what, if I pray hard enough, or if I have enough faith, then God's going to make this person who's sick get better. Or assumptions like, you know what, if God really cared about me, then I'd have a job by now. Wouldn't have been struggling for so long. You see, we make assumptions about God, and when things don't go the way that we think that they should, typically we conclude one of two things. Either we conclude God doesn't care. God doesn't exist. God failed. Something is wrong with God, or something's wrong with our idea of God, our particular concept of God. Or we conclude something's wrong with me. I'm a bad person. I've messed up way too much for God to help me. I didn't do enough. I didn't pray enough. I didn't believe hard enough. And all the while, we neglect to stop and ask the question, well, before I make any decisions or draw any conclusions, wait a second, what assumptions am I making about God? And I'm making about faith and how faith works. And where do those assumptions actually come from? Do they come from the scriptures? Do they come from Jesus, from how Jesus actually lived and how Jesus actually taught? Do they come from my parents? Do they come from a particular pastor or teacher or friend from my childhood? Do they come from a movie? Do they just come from kind of cultural in general? Where did these assumptions come from? And again, that's an incredible, helpful thing to try to wrestle through. Good exercise to work through. But all of that, assumptions we make about God, assumptions we make organizationally, well, I think all that can be really helpful. We're not going to take that really any farther this morning. And so instead, while that's really helpful, I want you to take that home and wrestle with it in your own mind and with some people that are close to you. But today, what I want to spend the majority of our time looking at instead are the assumptions that we make about other people. Assumptions about their heart and their character and their intentions. Now, granted, sometimes we make assumptions about people that are fairly accurate. That obviously happens. But many times the assumptions that we make aren't accurate. And very easily we can find ourselves enslaving other people and becoming enslaved ourselves by wrong assumptions. Which leads us to the ninth commandment in the Decalogue. For the last several weeks, we've been walking through the Ten Commandments, or known as the Ten Words, kind of in ancient Hebrew culture, or the Decalogue. And as we've said in different ways throughout this series, God didn't give these commands to try to make bad people good. God gave these commands to keep free people free. That's why he gave them. He didn't give commands to make bad people good. He gave commands to keep free people free. And that's the essence of every command that God gives. Which leads us to the ninth commandment, Exodus chapter 20, verse 16. Look what it says. It says, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Now, throughout the centuries, many times this particular command has been summarized by a simple imperative, kind of this idea of don't lie. That you shouldn't tell lies. You shouldn't tell lies about someone, or you shouldn't tell lies to someone. And understand, at a bare minimum, that's exactly how we should understand it. But the reality is most of you already embrace that. Most of you already can look at that and say, yeah, I know that. I know I shouldn't do that. Many of you, you know firsthand just how destructive and devastating lies can be. Most of you, if not all of you, you've experienced firsthand, and you've seen how lies burn away trust and how they sear relationships, and it doesn't matter what the lies were about, and it doesn't matter how well-intentioned or how malicious they were in a particular moment. Many of you, you've experienced how lies erode trust. It's just what lies do. And yet, at a very basic level, even though we tend to all know that, this ninth commandment is one that we can kind of find ourselves winking at. That in many of our minds, it kind of falls into this more flexible category than some of the other commands. That's why you'll often hear people when they get caught in a lie and they'll say things, well, it's not like I murdered somebody. It's not like I robbed a bank or something. In people's minds, it falls into a different type of category for us. Many times also like Sabbath. That falls into a much different category. I know God said take that seriously, but you know that's way more negotiable. But since it's one of the 10 foundational commandments given to us by God on how his people should live, that in turn have shaped our culture for thousands of years and have shaped culture all across the globe, it's worth wrestling through some of the implications that breaking or disregarding this ninth commandment has on our lives, has on culture, has on the world around us, and looking at it from a few more layers than just on the surface. Now, if you remember back to the third commandment reads, do not misuse the name of the Lord your God. Or more traditionally, it says, do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And several weeks ago, we talked about how the root of that was God saying, don't misrepresent who I am to other people. That the heart of the third commandment is don't misrepresent God's heart to other people. He says, don't misrepresent my intentions. Don't misrepresent who I am to others. And many times we can just do that flippantly. We can speak on God's behalf. We could say, oh, this is what God means by that. This is what God's doing. And we interpret events on behalf of God all the time for other people. And God says, whoa, 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 be very careful. Don't misrepresent who I am. And this ninth commandment of you should not bear or carry false witness against your neighbor, it carries with it the very similar idea as the third commandment, where the heart of it is, don't misrepresent who other people are. Don't misrepresent who other people actually are. Don't dishonor someone else's reputation. Don't steal or malign or murder someone's reputation in the eyes of other people. Now, there's times when we've done that, when it's very obvious to us. Perhaps you lied about someone to get even with them, to get back at them. There was this kind of sense of revenge that was boiling up in you, and so you lied to get back. Or perhaps you lied about someone out of a sense of fear to protect your own hide from accountability or from a sense of embarrassment. And so in this kind of mode of self-protection, then you lied. And in those moments, we're fairly aware of what we're doing. Now, we may try to justify it in our own minds, but regardless, most all of us that would be in this room, we tend to be aware of what we're actually doing in that moment. But what I want to focus the rest of our time on this morning are the times that may not be as blatantly obvious to us, where we end up bearing false witness against other people without really being aware of it. And at times doing more damage and perpetuating more darkness in the world than we ever thought we were possible to do with a commandment that we can so often tend to wink at. A couple weeks ago, we looked at the life of a man named Joseph in the book of Genesis, and we found him in the midst in Egypt being chased after by an Egyptian official's wife, where she was, you know, pursuing him and trying to get him to sleep with her, and he refused her advances. And what ends up happening in the rest of the story, he gets falsely accused by her and he ends up getting thrown in prison. And so years later, what you discover is that this same Joseph is in prison, and other prisoners had gotten freed over time, and they are actually in the presence of Pharaoh, the king of all Egypt. And Pharaoh has a dream, and he can't interpret the dream. And so some of these other former prisoners say, hey, we remember this guy back in prison. His name's Joseph. He could interpret dreams. And so he calls him up from the prison and he says, here's my dream. And Joseph ends up interpreting this dream for him that no one else in all of his kingdom could interpret for him. And so he ends up freeing him from prison and promoting him to leadership in Egypt. Look at what happens in Genesis chapter 41. It says, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift hand or foot in all Egypt. So all of a sudden, Joseph gets promoted to the second most powerful person in all of Egypt. An Israelite, a Hebrew, is the second most powerful person in all the land. After that, years later, we find that Pharaoh says to Joseph, hey, bring your father here. Bring your brothers and their families here. He has 11 brothers, their spouses, their kids, people that work with them, all of them. He says, bring them all. And it says, Pharaoh gave these Hebrews the very best of the land of Egypt. This pattern continued. More and more Israelites started coming into Egypt. Read what happens next here later on in Genesis chapter 47. It says, now the Israelites settled in Egypt in the region of Goshen. They acquired property there and were fruitful and increased greatly in number. So if you're a person who's kind of has a kind of a broad understanding of history, or at least a kind of a broad understanding maybe of some of the events in the Bible, one of the questions that is worth asking at this point then is, what went wrong between the Israelites and the Egyptians then? That all of a sudden, later on in history, we would find Moses having to lead the Israelites out of Egypt because the Israelites had been enslaved by the Egyptians for more than 400 years. What went wrong? Because this is the very end of Genesis. Genesis is 50 chapters and then begins Exodus and the story of Moses. So what happened? Things were going great. Something happened. Look at the first chapter of Exodus, chapter 1. It says, then Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt. Most scholars, when they kind of reflect back, think that this is Ramses II. Some, there's kind of debate about which king it actually is, but most of them land on Ramses II, who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. And what follows is 400 years of oppression and slavery. And you notice how it started with an assumption. With an assumption fueled by fear, fueled by weakness, insecurity. One that was made quickly in a new regime and that got passed down generation after generation after generation for over 400 years. You have to wonder, did those in power ever stop to ask? Do you think they ever stopped to ask in the midst of that 400 years, the powerful people in Egypt, why are Hebrews slaves? Why are they slaves? And if so, can you imagine the reasons that were given? Reasons of, oh, well, this is who they are. This is what they're like. This is what Hebrews are like. This is why they're slaves. And all these value and worth statements attached to who they were. But I doubt it was ever brought back to the reason that it was an assumption that a new king made. Notice in the text where it says, the new king did not know Joseph. Doesn't say he didn't know about Joseph. Joseph was the second most powerful person in all of Egypt. I'm sure he knew about him, but he didn't actually know him. And you see, sometimes we can just find ourselves going through life full steam ahead, and along the way, we find ourselves picking up certain assumptions from all sorts of different places and sources about particular people. And before long, we start carrying those assumptions with us. even passing them along to other people, to friends, to kids, to coworkers, to people that we want to impress, to Facebook friends, to Twitter followers. It just kind of happens. And again, life is moving so fast, and so we rarely stop long enough to consider the validity of the assumptions that we've made and how they may be causing us to misrepresent certain people's reputations and who they actually are. And in doing so, we often fail to realize just how toxic the ripple effects of that can be on other people, on culture, on entire groups of people, on our world. For example, I grew up in the suburbs of Louisville, Kentucky, and I had a very good childhood, had a great childhood, had great parents, had parents who from a very early age and taught me about Jesus and passed on great values and great character traits to me. But I remember pretty clearly driving around with some friends when I was in high school. And I don't know where I picked up certain assumptions, most likely just kind of the culture that I was surrounded with in the suburbs of a metropolitan city in Louisville. But I remember driving through downtown and we'd see homeless people from time to time and we would say things like, I just don't understand why they don't just get a job. Just lazy bums. Or we would drive through, you know, poor sections of town. And I had friends that were of all different types of races. It wasn't a race thing with us, but friends of all different types of races and that would be friends with me. And we would be driving around and we would drive through pretty poor sections of town. And we would find it pretty easy to malign people for what we were considered stupid decisions that they seemed to just be constantly making. But granted, I didn't know a single homeless person by name. Not one. I didn't know one person, actually know one person that I would have meaningful conversations with that I knew about them and who they were, who lived in the projects. But I had all these assumptions that I just carried with me about who they were, and what they were like. Then when I was 19 years old, I was invited to join a sports ministry team when I was in college, ironically called Cross Point. And it's a sports ministry that still exists today. And I was selected with six other kind of college athletes where they took us and they put us in the inner city of Baltimore and had us kind of live in a house together. So it was kind of like the real world without the cameras. And so, you know, they stuck us in the middle of this really rough part of town where we were to live for 3 months and we would go and host inner city sports camps for kids in local parks for free. And then we would just spend time getting to know the community and loving on them and just building relationships with them. And so I spent 3 months living in Baltimore in the roughest part of town. And the locals there considered it the worst street and the most dangerous street there in Baltimore that we lived on because there were two rival gangs that lived on the streets that kind of sandwiched our street together. And so our street was the main battleground. And so on a regular basis, drug deals went down every single day in front of me. Drive-by murders happened in front of me. Bullets were flying on a regular basis that you would hear even when you were walking down the street or at night. And so the world I lived in for those 3 months was very different than anything I had ever experienced in my life. But one of the great things that I got to do was I got to actually sit down and spend time with people that before I had not known really anything about. I got to sit down with people that were homeless and have conversations with them every day. Same people. I got to know them. I got to hear their stories. And I got to hear many of their desires to work and all the obstacles that they faced. That wasn't the case for everyone, but many of them desperately wanted work. But they kept running into all these obstacles, simply something like they didn't even have an address to put down on a job application. And so they wouldn't accept a P.O. box, these companies, because they were so skeptical. And so they wouldn't accept a P.O. box for an address. And so they would be turned down for that. Or if they didn't have a phone number and they would be rejected for jobs. And so they would keep going day after day, these interviews. Sometimes I would go with them to these interviews day after day and seeing them turned down and rejected time after time. And all of a sudden, I knew a whole lot more than I thought I did. And where I spent these months getting to know 11 and 12 and 13-year-old girls who had dropped out of school, and they were carrying a baby on their hip, and they were keeping up with another 3 or 4-year-old toddler running around. And as I got to know them and spend time with them in their home, I started to come to understand that it was an all too common story where dad was in jail and mom had died of AIDS. And these young 11 and 12-year-old girls found themselves stuck between trying to care for their own flesh and blood, the only family that they had, and pursuing an education. And they felt like they were stuck with an impossible choice. I'll never forget seeing a little 7-year-old boy. He's playing baseball one day with us in a park, and he steps up to home plate. And before he hits, he rolls up his pants. He reaches into his sock and he pulls out a knife about 5 inches long, and he sticks it in the ground. 7-year-old boy proceeds to hit the ball, works his way around the bases, and eventually comes back home, picks up the knife, sticks it back in his sock. And I looked at him, I said, "Buddy, so what in the world are you doing? Why you got to carry a knife around?" And he said, "I've got to protect myself if I want to make it through the day." See, this was a reality in a context that he was living with every day that I had no idea about. And as I got to know people, as I got to actually know people, I realized I had been carrying with me a lot of false assumptions about people, about groups of people, categories of people. Assumptions that I hadn't really hesitated in sharing really with others before in my mind, because that's just the way things were. That was reality in my mind. They seemed like facts in my mind. But you see, that's such a dangerous mindset to settle into, where you can find yourself saying things like, "I just can't stand blanks." Or, you know what? Blanks are what is wrong with the world today. And in those blanks, you can insert any particular group or category of people. You hear people do it all the time, whether that group is labeled by religion or ethnicity or race or political affiliation or gender or sexual orientation or nationality or lifestyle, social status, career, any category you want to put into those blanks. And when you find yourself tempted to do that, understand often at the root of those beliefs are assumptions that you've picked up somewhere along the way. Many times you don't even know where they came from. Maybe they were just passed down from you generationally. Maybe they were just passed down to you culturally. Many times, though, you've never actually even known someone in a group that you have such a problem with. You don't even know one person's name in that group or category that you've ever had meaningful conversations with. Sometimes you actually do know. You're like, "Oh, I know." And you know one or two. And your experience with them has caused you to assume that's what everyone in that category is like. And so it comes across as, and out of our mouth as, "Well, you know what, all rich people are blank. All poor people are blank. All Christians are. All Muslims are. All Democrats are. All Republicans are. All Carolina fans are. All Duke fans are." And you find yourself very quickly being able to finish some of those sentences in your mind. And when you're able to do that, and what comes to mind is something negative, then perhaps certain assumptions about certain groups of categories or people have gripped you more than you think. And you may think to yourself, "Wait a second, ninth commandment, I've not broken that. I've never borne false witness against someone, false testimony against someone. I've never stood up in court and lied about someone." But perhaps what you've done is you've nurtured false witness in your heart for a long time. You've carried false witness with you for a long time. And like the new king in Exodus, you've settled for knowing about rather than actually knowing. And in the process, what can become lost is that in any particular group, there are actual people, there are actual individuals that bear the image of God, and that we are called at a very foundational level to love. And so if we want to be people who take the way of God seriously, who take the way of Jesus seriously, Jesus who hangs everything he ever taught on love God and love people, then I want to leave you with just a couple handles that you can take with you to help you navigate this better. And so if you feel like writing something down, I'd encourage you to write this down. Grace assumes that the ninth commandment is constantly being broken all around you. Grace assumes that the ninth commandment is constantly being broken all around you. And that when you hear something about someone that puts them in a negative light, that you hold what you hear loosely. Now, that's not saying to ignore it. That's not saying that the assumption is never wrong. It's simply that you choose to hold it loosely, because you live with an awareness that the ninth commandment is constantly being broken all around you. Just the other day, I was speaking with Stephen Claybrook, our worship pastor. He texted me this morning. He's got the flu. So if you think about Stephen or send him some love on Facebook or Twitter or something like that, you'd be hard pressed to find a better heart for people than Stephen Claybrook's heart. And I watched him do this right in front of me the other day where he asked me a question, and I expressed some hesitations about entrusting this particular person with leadership in this particular situation. And when I asked him, I said, "Hey, are you aware of any of the reasons that may cause some of the hesitation on my part?" He said, "Well, you know, I've only heard one thing, but it was from one particular person's vantage point of how the situation went down. And then that got passed through to someone else who then in turn told me. And so I just hold what I heard very loosely." And that was it. That's all he said. And I thought, you know what? That's exactly what you're supposed to do. And he didn't ignore it, but he didn't draw any conclusions from secondhand information either. He didn't draw conclusions, good or bad. He just held it loosely. And that discipline of mind starts with understanding that the ninth commandment is constantly being broken all around you. After all, in a world of media headlines, fighting for attention, fighting for mouse clicks, fighting for magazines sold and advertising dollars, we have to be awakened to the truth of passages like Proverbs 18, where it says, "Listening to gossip is like eating cheap candy." See, gossip and cheap candy both get consumed without even thinking about it, isn't it? It's a decision of impulse. Just gets consumed. Think about it a little bit more for a moment. Where in the grocery store do you always find the gossip magazines? Next to the cheap candy. You see, we haven't changed all that much in thousands and thousands of years from when this proverb was written. Whether it's a celebrity, whether it's an author, whether it's a boss, whether it's a pastor, whether it's a friend of a friend or a second cousin's twice removed hairdresser, whether it's someone who holds political office or is running for political office. Friends, listen, please hear me on this. As people of faith, as people striving to follow Jesus, we have to do a much better job of how we talk about people that we don't actually know. We have to do a much better job. While I'm at it, just as a side note, since I've got a microphone, since we're about to head into this hyped up political season over the next year, if politics are your thing, no matter what party you align with, I know faithful followers of Jesus on all sides of the political spectrum. You should feel free to dialogue and debate different issues in politics and policies and approaches to running the country all day long. And feel free, if that's your thing, that's what you're into, you just go for it. But I'm asking you that in doing so, as people seeking to follow Jesus, that you keep the ninth commandment at the very forefront of your mind as you do. That you do not find yourself bearing false witness against people in terms of their heart, in terms of their character, in terms of who they actually are as people. Whether in your conversations, whether in your speech, whether on Facebook, wherever it is, be very careful about how you speak about someone's character and intent. Because while you may know about someone based on platforms or based on decisions, the reality is 99% of us in this room don't actually know. We don't. You don't know about their character and their intent and their heart. Which begs the question, lastly, is what about people then that we do know? Because there are some people that you know very well. The ninth commandment says, "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor." But there are some people that you can witness to their actions firsthand. Not only that, but you've witnessed continual patterns of behavior and degrees of toxicity that the assumptions that you hold toward them are pretty accurate. Now, we've talked through this many times before about confronting people with grace and then truth. And we've talked about the importance of guardrails and boundaries in certain relationships. And so obviously, I'm not asking you to neglect those or to ignore those. There's tons of wisdom in that. But at the same time, just because you're convinced that your assumptions are accurate, it does not give you license to go and spread that around to anyone and everyone who will listen. Again, that's not to say It's not to say that there's not wisdom in having a couple close, trusted people in your life that you can vomit on and that can help speak into your life and that can help you navigate through certain situations in your life. It is not saying that. But you have to understand that in the moment, you're going to feel like I need to share this with everyone who will listen because I know it's accurate. I know it's true. So I'm going to share it with whoever will listen. You need to pay really close attention to that impulse because with much respect, that impulse is often a childish insistence for cheap candy. It's a childish insistence for cheap candy that you think in the moment you have to have, that emotions in you demand that you have to have it. But you don't. It's not what it looks like to love people. And again, we're not talking about abusive situations. I'm not talking about, you know, the appropriateness of certain boundaries and all of that. Not getting in that. I'm not talking about that. We address that quite often. But with all those disclaimers here, hopefully you hear my heart in this and you trust that. But I want to back off the extremes for a moment. And here's what I want to land on. Some of you have spent a lot of time misrepresenting people that you know. Misrepresenting people that you know well. Whether it's misrepresenting your husband to your girlfriends when you say things like, he's always doing this. He's never doing this. Whether it's misrepresenting your wife to your buddies when you talk about, you know what, she is always on me for this. For some of you, you've spent a lot of time misrepresenting a teacher, misrepresenting a boss to anybody that'll listen. You really don't want the finger of blame pointed at you, and so you want to convince other people it's their fault. You want to shine the light on them, put the blame on them. Some of you, you spent years misrepresenting parents. Some parents, you spent time misrepresenting your kids to other people, your in-laws, an ex. And at times what happens is at the root of that is somebody let you down. Somebody disappointed you. Somebody you cared about. You had certain expectations in your mind of what someone would say, what someone would do, how someone would respond in a particular situation, and they didn't. And maybe that moment was last week. Maybe it was 3 months ago. Maybe it was 5 years ago. Maybe it was 10 years ago. But ever since then, everything gets filtered through that moment for you. And maybe you don't go around saying all sorts of false witness about these people, but perhaps emotionally you carry false witness in your heart toward them. And it shapes your attitude toward them and the way that you think about them. And what it's like, it's like someone fell into a pit and no matter what they do, you're not letting them out. Because everything gets filtered through that moment when they failed your expectations. And as a result, you hold on to all these assumptions about what these people really are like and who they really are and what they really think about you. And when that may not be the case at all, perhaps they just had a bad day. They had a bad moment. Perhaps they had a really tough season. Perhaps there's all sorts of other factors and context that you're not even aware of that were going on in the background, that if you knew, it would change your perspective drastically. Maybe not. Maybe that wouldn't be the case. But maybe it would be. Maybe it would be. And in those moments, we have to remember, if we're going to love people the way that we want to be loved, we have to remember, how is it that we want to be loved? Because each of us want to be loved in such a way where people judge us by our intentions and not just by our actions and words that come out of our mouths sideways at times. That's why when we mention this all the time in here, so many times we're like, man, we want to be judged by our intentions. That's not how I meant it to come out. That's not what I said. I was emotional. I was tired. I said, it was stupid that I said it. I'm so sorry. That is not what my heart really thinks. I'm sorry. And we want people to see our intentions. But so often our tendency is we want to judge other people by their actions and their failed expectations. Not by that. We don't want to care about their intention. We don't want to care about their heart. We just want to pay attention to their actions and their words. But we so desperately don't want people to treat us that way. And we live as though it's okay for us to have incredibly high expectations of everyone else, but we don't want them to have those same standards for us. And so here's the very last thing I want to leave you with. One handle, one exercise to take with you out the door, and it's this. What would it look like for you to literally stop? To hit the pause button. And here's the exercise I want you to do this week. I want you to make a list of some 5 to 10 people in your life. People that are close to you, people that you don't really know, maybe groups of people that you hold some strong assumptions about. You pick one from each category, pick a couple from each category. 5 to 10 people. I'm not talking about the whole world. I'm not talking about all the people you have assumptions with. I'm saying 5 or 10. I want you to take that group of people and I want you to hit the refresh button on your assumptions about them. Clean the slate. And then I want you to ask the question, where did the assumptions come from that I have about them? That you would risk disbelieving your own thoughts and your own emotions that you have toward a particular person, toward a particular group of people, that you would risk disbelieving your own thoughts and emotions and allow yourself to hit the refresh button. Now, as you do that, I'm not saying that you might not come back to the very same conclusions. You may. But that we would not be the kind of people that would just speed through life. That we would find ourselves like the Egyptians, just going through life without ever stopping to pause and to ask the question, where did this assumption actually come from? To really wrestle that to the ground and ask, where does this come from? This assumption about them. Where does it come from that we wouldn't be the kind of people that don't have the courage and the wisdom to stop and actually ask the question? And then you would take those assumptions, you would hold them, and you would let Jesus speak into them. And you'd see what happens. You'd see what happens. And that we would be the kind of people, we'd be the kind of people who take the way of Jesus seriously, who take the way of God seriously, because we are trusting that he is always leading us toward life, that he is always leading us toward freedom, and he is inviting us into a way, into a life that leads toward redemption and resurrection, not only of others, but of the whole world. And we'd have the courage to walk in it. So let's pray. Father, thanks for your word, and thanks for the power of your word. And so God, very humbly, we ask for the courage to take all the assumptions that we have, to hold them up, and to really let you speak into them and to really think about where they come from. And so, Father, as we do, would you lead us into life? We love you and thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks, friends.